Okay, we want to talk about the shaping of our modern world and then tie in what we've been talking about for Christian history, particularly American Christian history, because, you know, we're Americans, so we kind of like to focus on that aspect of it. I want to read, first of all, a very important passage of Scripture, I think, that deals with this. 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5. Understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. For men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Now listen to this last part. Having the appearance of godliness, but denying its power. Avoid such people. So Paul, through the Holy Spirit, predicts that there's going to arise religion without righteousness. Religion without morality. And we certainly have seen that at different phases throughout history. But I think in our modern period, and when we talk about the modern period, we're talking about the 1900s, the 20th century, that really came full force here in the United States. Let's talk about the population explosion, first of all. In 1804, when Thomas Jefferson was president of the very young United States, that's when the world population hit 1 billion. 1927, so over 120 years later, is when it got to the 2 billion mark. Then, in 1959, the year before I was born, that's when it hit 3 billion. 1974, I was a teenager, wasn't yet driving, it hit 4 billion. 1987, I was in college, it hit 5 billion. 1999, I was living up here and preaching, 6 billion. That means in the time between my birth and when I hit 40, the world population doubled in that short period of time. It hit 7 billion in 2011, not very long ago. And it is estimated that in somewhere in the middle of the 20s, it will hit its 8 billion mark. Now, interestingly enough, it's starting to slow down because what happens is in industrialized countries, which pretty much all countries are industrialized now, the birth rate flattens. When you have lots of, quote, time-saving devices, you do not tend to have as many kids. And therefore, countries like the United States end up having only pretty much a replacement birth rate that eventually takes hold. Current birth rate here in the United States is like 2.3 kids per couple. That also. Longer lifespan tends to contribute also to a lower birth rate. And therefore the and population, yeah. Okay. All of these things feed into the idea that the world, the planet, is not going to be probably overrun by people before Jesus comes back, because most ecosystems self-correct anyway. we're not overrun by rabbits, even though they have a high birth rate, because their population self-corrects so that they don't over-forage and things like that. Even in Australia, where they were introduced and they didn't really have any predators, they still haven't, like, overtaken the entire country. Unless God wanted them to, and then, it, of course, it would happen. But I just want you to be aware that we are living in the time where the population curve hit its maximum, hit its peak during the 20th century, going into the 21st. Now, at the beginning of the 1900s, we already talked about this, and I want to reemphasize it. There was this fight, this confrontation between the liberals, the progressive Christians, and I use that in air quotes, and the fundamentalists. And the Bible was the mechanism by which a lot of this fight took place. The liberals thought that the Bible was just literature, and you glean from it the things that were of interest to you. But the fundamentalists saw it as what you needed for life and godliness. And so the publication of Bibles was very important for Christians who were Bible-based. And one of the really important books of the early 1900s was the King James Version Scofield Reference Bible. It was first published in 1909. It kept being published right up until the present day. I got a copy of it when I was in junior high, I think, and kept it around and did a lot of my research out of it. So it was fundamentalist in its notes. It was also premillennial dispensationalist, which means it believed that Jesus was going to come back and rule and reign literally on the earth for 1,000 years. But it also believed, the dispensationalist part of this, was that he would rule and reign with a Jewish flavor. That is, the Gentile church was going to be taken off into heaven, and the Jewish people were going to be given a new kingdom that would be all related to them. And I am not a dispensationalist. I am a premillennialist, but not a dispensationalist. So I always had problems with those parts of the notes. That book gave rise to a lot of other study Bibles and versions. I didn't put it in here, but a ton of different translations came out right around the beginning of the 1900s. New American Standard, actually the American Standard first, and then the New American Standard later, made their appearance. Later in the century, the NIV. Lots and lots and lots of Bibles in different flavors because there was a demand for it. Lots of people wanted to read the Bible. Now, weirdly enough, a lot of the people that wanted to read the Bible didn't really believe the Bible. They were just interested in it as literature. And so that's why you have some of them being just paraphrases and things of that nature, which were just intended to sound nice when you read it. Now, World War II, of course, came along at the beginning of the 20th century, and it represents the beginning of a whole bunch of death. I mean, a ton of death. The estimated total casualty rate for the period of World War I was 16.5 million people. About not quite 10 million of those were military casualties. The rest of them were civilian casualties, because civilians always die during wars, always, because they get caught up in the disease and the lack of supplies, as well as the fighting that follows war. Now, of American military members, of those deaths, only about 116,000 Americans. Now, that seems like an awful big number, but look at it in comparison to the total of military casualties. it was the Europeans that suffered the most during World War I. But at the end of World War I, that's when the big Spanish flu epidemic broke out. And that took a much bigger toll than World War I. It is estimated between 50 to 100 million people all over the world died because of the flu epidemic that year. Because remember, there's also a lot of people moving around. And so it got spread everywhere. Remember, we've got ship traffic that's going everywhere, and we've got a lot of military members moving around, and they're passing this stuff around. Now, I'll give you something to kind of chew on in relationship to that. The American deaths of that particular flu epidemic were 650,000. Now, that is a bunch, but again, it's not anywhere near the total of the people that died. And to give you something to standardize on that, the average deaths per year here in the United States for flu or flu-related deaths, 37,000. And so I don't know what the current flu epidemic is in relationship to that, but I don't think it's close to that yet, or that it's looked like it's going to get anywhere near the average at this point. Because of all this death, particularly because of the war death, the League of Nations is put into place. Woodrow Wilson was a big pusher of that. President Woodrow Wilson was a major progressive. He believed government was the solution to everything. And he was very modernistic in all his approaches, including to religion. He was not a big supporter of biblical Christianity. He thought that religion should be kind of a motivator for progressivism, that is, to help people become better as a group as we move forward as part of humanity. So here's the quote from the League of Nations. In order to promote international cooperation and to achieve international peace and security. Now, that line is reproduced in the preamble of the United Nations Charter. And weirdly enough, it is a quote, or it comes very close to being a quote, from Paul's warning to Timothy that there will be people in the last day saying, peace and security, but sudden destruction is going to come upon them. In fact, I didn't realize that that was the case until one day I was doing some research in that particular passage in Timothy, and I was searching in the Greek language. So I was looking for the Greek words. And so I put it into my search engine, and boom, up something pops that's related to the United Nations. And I'm like, what? And so then I kind of jump into it, and I find out it's the Greek website for the United Nations, and it's the quote from the preamble of the United Nations Charter, and it's those exact two words, peace and security, in the UN Charter, and I'm like, whoa, that was kind of weird. To promote or achieve international peace and security by the acceptance of obligations not to resort to war, by the prescription of open, just, and honorable relations between nations, by the firm establishment of the understandings of international law as the actual rule of conduct among governments, and by the maintenance of justice and scrupulous respect for all treaty obligations in the dealings of organized peoples with one another, agree to this covenant of the League of Nations. Now, why is that important for us as we're looking at church history? Well, this is a push for world government. That's exactly what it was. And it's a push for world government that is not founded on God, but on government itself and upon the laws put in place by the various governments. Do our laws here in the United States, as it was originally founded as a Bible-believing nation, do our laws have an exact equivalence to the laws in an atheistic country like China? No, they wouldn't come anywhere near one another. See, because their standard on which their laws were based is totally different than our standard. But the League of Nations was pushing this idea that there has to be this international standard that everyone accepts. And it's the government that has to push this standard. And so the League of Nations, of course, fails miserably because it was established after World War I to prevent any other world wars. What happens next? World War II is going to happen. And so it is an absolute failure. But we've got other wars that are going on too. 1918 kicked off the Russian Civil War, which eventually gives rise in 1923 to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic. And during that particular war, 4.6 million Russians others in that same region of the world died because of the fight of the Soviets to take over the region. And of course, that becomes the new threat to the Western world, because the Soviet Union believed that they had the task of making the world a Soviet government, which is not God-based. It is based upon the ideas of socialism, which is from the abilities of the many to the needs of the many. So you basically decide what everybody needs as a government, and then you make everybody contribute to that. Now, the weirdness is that there's always the group at the top that administers everything. And they always, as the administrators, get a bigger chunk of the stuff. And that's always been the problem with socialism. Yeah, go ahead. Yep. That's because all of the trade union stuff that started in the United States started around the same time with the same concept. Yeah, I am not a... Okay, some of you are not going to like me for this. I am not a big supporter of modern unions. When they first started, some of the concepts were to protect the people from horrible working conditions and practical slavery by the owners. Got a big problem that was going on at that time. There needed to be a solution. I think the Bible should have been the solution to that, not the Soviet model. And the idea today, where many unions are, if you're not in our union, you shouldn't get to work. That's not appropriate. Yeah, it is changing a little bit more. But yes, it came out of this same period with the same motivations. The Chinese Civil War is also motivated by that stuff. It started in 27, went to 49, so it finished World War II. A lot of people died for that. I don't even know that we have really good casualty figures. But a lot of people died in that war. And it gave rise to Red China, but it also gave rise to the Republic of China, which we know of as Taiwan. We've also got stuff going on in the Middle East during this time period, because the Brits, of course, beat the Turks in the Middle East during the time of World War I, and they took over the administration of the Middle Eastern area. And they made a promise to Jewish people the world over that they were going to give to the Jewish people a homeland in their ancient promised land, because there were already a lot of them living there, and there were more that were wanting to go there. And particularly during World War II, where Hitler specifically targeted world Jewry in Europe, the promise was made to the Jewish people, you will have a place where you can go and be safe. And so here is what the British mandate says on that. Whereas the principal Allied powers, that's World War II, the winners, have also agreed that the mandatory should be responsible for putting into effect the declaration originally made on November the 2nd, 1917, by the government of His Britannic Majesty. That's referred to as the Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration was England saying, there will be an Israeli homeland in the Promised Land. Now, the vast majority of the Jewish people in the Promised Land at that time lived near the coast. They didn't live up by Jerusalem. There were a few, but most of them lived down on the western side of what used to be the Promised Land. So it was adopted by the said powers in favor of the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, it being clearly understood that nothing should be done which might prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So this British mandate that comes into full existence at the end of World War II guaranteed that the Jewish people would have a homeland, a protected homeland, in the Middle East, but that it would not intrude on the religious rights of the Muslims already living there, alongside them, and that it should not be construed to take away the rights of Jewish people all over the world who choose to stay where they were at. That's the way World War II wrapped up. And it's not going to be accepted by the Muslims in the Middle East. We'll talk about that in a moment. Now, what's going on here in the United States around that time? Well, you've got the Great Depression that happens starting in 29, and it goes right up through the 40s. It's kicked off by a whole bunch of spending money that people didn't have and investing in a stock market and blowing the stock market way high when it shouldn't have been that high. Not unlike what's happening right now, honestly. And eventually the bubble popped. And when it popped, a lot of people lost a lot of fake money that their lives were dependent upon. And because of that, companies also collapsed. And 2.5 million Americans also had to immigrate from the central plains of the United States, because while the Depression is going on, the Dust Bowl blows up because they've been out there tilling the plains to put in wheat fields and all of that, and they didn't use good management, and all of that started blowing around, and it was horrible. And so all those people can no longer stay where they're at, so they move, many of them out to the west, out to the west coast. And when you have huge migrations of people moving into another place, when there are already very few jobs in those places, you end up with huge unemployment numbers. The U.S. average unemployment peak was 25% unemployment in 33. And of course, it was higher in some places. And it was still clear up in the 14% unemployment rate. And we're talking about the real unemployment rate here that was in existence. And World War II going into, America joining World War II is probably what ended the Depression. because the New Deal that FDR was doing before that was actually making things worse. But his concept was government always does things better. And the government needs to be the one that saves the people, even if it saves them from themselves. Yep. All of that stuff was going on. Yep. Government assistance. The government basically becomes the new god of the American people who are in poverty. Less and less of them go to churches, although some of them go to the big churches that are now social gospel churches. But guess what? Those churches are cooperating with the government to try to get the government to be the one that's doing most of the work. Remember that the tax, the income tax, came into existence around the time at the end of World War I, with the excuse we have to pay off the debts for World War I. But it stayed and expanded in order to pay for all the government programming of the New Deal. And it's been expanding ever since then. Most of the budget of the United States government right now is social spending. Yep. Yeah, we were involved in rebuilding in Germany and France and all that in after World War I, and of course after World War II, same thing. Part of that was the mindset, I think, the remnant of the Christian mindset that you need to help people get back up, even after they've been punished for their sin. If they're repentant, you help them back up. But in this case, it was more of the governments. Since the governments that were left in those countries were no longer the governments that committed the crime of the war, then you needed to help them out.
Well, I asked that because was that about the time that they started taking taxes from us?
So that taxes were also involved in that, yeah, sure. Yep. The tax rate that Americans pay today is a whole bunch bigger than the sorts of tax rates that occurred in the early colonies and the early United States. Remember, those taxes were not income taxes. Those taxes were usage taxes, basically. Import, export, sales taxes, things like that. It wasn't until the 1900s that the idea of an income tax came into existence in the United States. In fact, I think Doug even mentioned this last week. Many people argued against the implementation of the tax amendment because they said, this is unconstitutional. Taxes are never to be taken from the individual. Who cares? If you are a progressive who believes that government needs to do everything for people, then that's all the excuse you need to take taxes in order to do that. And now we are in such a place that it would be very, very hard to go backwards from the way that it is taking place now. World War II, of course, comes into play from 39 to 45. We entered it in 41. The total estimated deaths, 60 million people. 20 million of them were military. 40 million were the civilians. A lot of death and destruction. We lost about 400,000 plus military members from the United States. And of course, that indicated that the League of Nations is not working. So they came up with a new plan, which is the United Nations. And here is the explanation of the of the implementation of the United Nations. We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. And for these ends, to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security, there's those words again, by the way, from Timothy, and to ensure by the acceptance of principles and the institution of methods that armed forces shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of economic and social advancement of all peoples. And then it goes on and talks about what's going on in San Francisco to get this established. Do you notice that God is not mentioned anywhere in any of that? It's only about government. Because you see, the 20th century had moved into this belief system that humans, through government, must save themselves. And that government must be given great amounts of authority to carry out its responsibility of saving humanity. They actually wanted at this time to have the United Nations be the only military left in the world. But it didn't happen because a lot of people just felt they couldn't trust the other nations that were involved in it. But they continue to push that idea. That idea is still floating out there that all the governments of the world need to give up their own independent militaries and accept a United Nations military. And we have peacekeepers that are the first components of that idea. The Blue Hats. And I remember it's only been a couple of decades now since the first United States military member was prosecuted because he said, "I will not accept orders from a blue hat." And he was discharged from the military because he was told, "This person is going to be in your chain of command. You must accept his orders." When his argument through his lawyer was, "They are not in the United States military chain of command. I should not have to accept orders from them." But he lost. Because you see, the United States is moving more and more to this idea that we are a world government, not just an independent United States government. How did they select the soldiers from the UN? I am not altogether certain how they do that. Oh yeah, there are American soldiers that are blue hatters. Yeah. What's that? No, I think you basically just get put on duty from your United States military service into one of those units. What's that? Yeah, it's whoever they would want to put in. But the ultimate goal is to do away with all national militaries and put it just as an international military. And we're seeing some of the precursors of that already in the United States military. United States military is going into a joint forces sort of program where they're trying to do away with all the different branches. They've all started to adopt the same military uniforms. Not their dress uniforms yet, but all of their battle dress uniforms, their BDUs, are looking more and more exactly alike. And they will, I'm guessing probably the next thing that they will do is they will start making the rank structure exactly the same across all of the forces. Because there's variant ways that you talk about the ranks. But even now, many of the bases are referred to as joint base this or joint base that. And you're never sure whether or not your commander is going to be in the same branch as you. When I was in Gulf War I, you know, that quite a few years ago now, my chain of command included the Navy. Our unit, our Air Force unit, answered to a Navy admiral. It was weird. It felt weird when we got there. So, oh well. We did get good chow, though. Navy always has good chow. So, John, did you?
You answered it.
Yeah, the joint bases. I think that's actually all part of the plan to unify the United States military into one. And then, of course, then they will move on to unifying all of the military forces.
When I was at Fort Hood, we had the base. There's definitely,
you can see that. Yeah, and you know what? Most of the training bases, even today, have other nations' forces they're training with ours. And that, I think, is also intentional. The Tobin tax, if you ever heard of that, the Tobin tax has been pushed for a long time now to be a world tax in order to fund the United Nations and its military. It keeps getting rejected in a lot of places, but they keep putting back out again, because this whole idea is to move to a one world government. That is the ultimate goal, and of course, if you're a Bible prophecy person, you know that that's eventually where it ends up anyway. So the League of Nations gives up and goes away in 46, and I put their last comments there. The League is dead. Long live the United Nations. So they're all pro-United Nations, even though they had to acknowledge that they failed to keep things peaceful. That's 48 is when the Arab-Israeli thing happens. The 47 UN plan to establish the homeland for the Jewish people and to pull back the British mandate. The day that happened, all of the Muslim nations around this new homeland said, we're not going to put up with that. We don't care what the UN says. We are going to annihilate this Jewish nation in its infancy and push the Jews into the sea. Then, of course, they got their clocks cleaned. Even though the Israelis were smaller in number and had very limited amounts of equipment, some pretty amazing things happened, and they won. So UN Resolution 194, that happens in 1948. It has quite a few articles in it, but here are the most common articles that are quoted. Article 7 says that there should be protection and free access to the holy places. That's always been a big bugaboo, is that Jerusalem has both Jewish, Christian, and supposedly Muslim holy places, although the whole idea about the Muslim places on the Temple Mount being original there from the beginning of Islam is highly questionable. They seem to have just been placed there after the Muslims took it over by force. But anyway, it's supposed to be protection of all those holy sites. Article 8 says that the UN should basically be in control of Jerusalem, and that they're the only military that really should be parading around. Now, the Israelis accepted that for a while, but after a couple more wars, they keep their people there. But the UN still has a presence there, and they're still pushing the idea that Jerusalem should be just declared an international city under UN jurisdiction. In fact, there was a plan offered one time to move the UN to Jerusalem. Article 9, there should be free access to Jerusalem by all parties. And then Article 11, this is the one that gets called for a lot, that all the refugees should have the right of return. Now remember, this is 1948. The reason there were refugees is not often talked about today. In 1947, when these Muslim nations surrounding the Jews said, we're going to come in and wipe out the Jews. You guys need to move out of our way. We'll let you come back later after we've taken them out of the picture, and then you can come and live in where you used to. In fact, you'll even have more properties because we'll have killed off all the Jews. So those guys, of their own free will, left those properties and went out to refugee camps elsewhere. But it didn't turn out the way they'd been told. The Israelis won. The Muslims lost. So the refugees were stuck in all these camps. And they're like, we want to go home. And so that whole generation has died off pretty much now. And it's their kids and their grandkids that are still saying, hey, we have a right of return. We should be able to go back in there and take over the properties that the Jews have after they defended themselves and beat up the Muslim countries. But you know what? I say tough. If your neighbor left their house, your neighbors, let's make it plural, your neighbors left their houses because a few streets over, another bunch of neighbors said, you know what, we're going to go in and we're going to kill and take over the property of this guy. And when we're done, you guys can come back and you can have his property. You can divide it amongst yourselves. But it doesn't happen that way. And in fact, in the process, you end up having to occupy the houses that were emptied by your neighbors. Guess what? As far as I'm concerned, and as far as international law has been concerned up to this point, that property is yours. Because you took it as part of a self-defense effort. And so I am not a fan of anybody that suggests that the Israelis should give up land. They took it defending themselves from atrocious behavior. And the people who cooperated in that have no rights as far as I'm concerned. If they want to go anywhere, let them go to the Muslim countries that told them that they'd have some property after this was all over with. The 1949 armistice, after all this was over, that's what's resulted in referred to as the Green Line. It's because it was green on the maps. I put one of the maps off here to the side. It's really weird looking. And Jerusalem is like just a little small portion of what was the Israeli homeland as dictated by the UN resolution. Now, since that time, there's been a couple more wars. 67, 74, I think. And each time that the Muslims keep trying to take on the Israelis and take their property away from them, guess who wins? The Israelis. And so the Israelis keep expanding more and more of their territory because of self-defense. And so they currently are technically in control of Eastern Jerusalem, which includes the Temple Mount, the Old City. But they allow the Muslim religious authorities run it. Which, again, I don't understand why they allowed that, but that was their choice. This, I think, still feeds into the prophecy that Jerusalem would be trampled down underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles being fulfilled kicks off the final 3.5 years. And so we're still in the times of the Gentiles by that standard. Okay, any comments or questions on that? Sometimes that comes as a shock to a lot of people because they're like thinking that the Israelis should let the refugees come back. After all, they have a right of return. No, that was the grandparents who had the right of return. And the right of return was based on the idea that they thought the Israelis were going to lose. That's correct. The Israelis have given back a lot more territory than I would have. I'm telling you right now, I would have kept it as a buffer zone. But they've given back a ton of the property that they took in self-defense. They even most recently gave back Gaza. And they gave back Gaza and kicked out a whole bunch of their own citizens out of those regions. And Gaza was a wonderful place for fruit being grown there in really high-tech greenhouses and things. And as soon as the Israelis forced their own citizens out of Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Muslims went in there, dismantled all of that high-tech, really good fruit-growing equipment, and started using the place as a base to lob rockets into Israel. So I'm telling you right now, if I were Israeli, there'd be no more giving back any property. I don't care. Because every time they do, they get nothing but grief. And the Palestinians just need to suck it up and go live in a Muslim country. You want me to tell you how I really feel? All right. So we've got some other things here that are related to the Soviet, the socialism thing. Chiang Kai-shek was an anti-communist who, after World War II was finished, kept fighting the communists in China. See, he was actually one of our allies during World War II. And we were supposed to support him as the new leader of a free China after it was all over with. But we didn't do such a good job about that. And so he ends up retreating to the island of Formosa, where my son was born many years later. And on Formosa, Chiang Kai-shek set up a Republic of China, a free China. And it's now known as Taiwan. And it is China's constant attempt to take back control of that little island because it is a blight on their Soviet concept. It is a constant reminder that Soviet sort of philosophy does not work well because Taiwan is much better off economically and technologically than anywhere in China, in the Soviet China, even to this day. Hong Kong was recently given back to the Chinese. It's still doing okay, but do you know why? Because Communist China decided to keep running it as if it were still old Hong Kong. And so they've kind of made overtures that they'd like to do the same thing with Formosa, that if they could have it back, they'll allow it to keep running by its Western ideals. But I don't know that I would trust that. Okay? Korean War. Korean War was all about the fight with communism as well. It was estimated that almost 3 million people died, 900,000 of those were military and 2 million were civilian. And about 53,000 Americans died there. We could also talk about Vietnam being a continuation of that same sort of effort. Korean War and the Vietnam War are actually continuations of World War II because the Soviets decided they would use the end of World War II as an expansion time, that they would try to push the Soviet doctrine all over the place, particularly in the eastern part of Asia. And American military doctrine was, no, we cannot allow that to happen. It needs to be contained because it is dangerous. Some of our military commanders were very upset that we cooperated with the Soviets during World War II. And they were most certainly upset that at the end of defeating the Axis, we didn't turn around and attack the Soviets and get rid of them. I think that was one of Patton's ideas. He thought that we should turn around and just attack them immediately to put down this threat to the entire world. But it didn't happen. So we ended up fighting it on smaller fronts like Korea and Vietnam. Okay, any other comments or questions on all that stuff? The last several pages of your notes, I'm going to give you the chance to pretty much read these on your own, and I would encourage you to do it. I know most of you probably won't, but I'm going to encourage you to do it anyway. what happens in the post-World War II period is that Christianity in America becomes progressive and secularized. So that when you talk about Christianity from that time period on, it has no real anchor in Bible Christianity. Even the Pledge of Allegiance, where it has under God, and a lot, I know a lot of people were really upset because under God was being removed from the pledge. Well, you know, the under God was not added to the pledge until 1954. It was put there more of a response to this idea that we're different than the Soviets. We're different than the communists because we've got religion, you know, and we've got to put that in quotations here. We've got a morality that's different than them. And so that's why it was pushed into the pledge. It's why it was put on the coins at that time as well, in God We Trust. Even though that had been a long-standing motto for the United States, it was put on the coins by Eisenhower. But a significant book that helps explain a lot of this change was written in 1955. The name of the book is Protestant Catholic Jew, An Essay on American Religious Sociology. Okay? Now, here is the excerpt from the introduction, and I'm going to read the third paragraph of that introduction excerpt. The religion which actually prevails among Americans today has lost much of its authentic Christian or Jewish content. Even when they are thinking, feeling, or acting religiously, their thinking, feeling, and acting does not bear an unequivocal relation to the faiths they profess. Americans think, feel, and act in terms quite obviously secularist, at the very same time that they express every sign of widespread religious revival. It is this secularism of a religious people, this religiousness in a secularist framework, that constitutes the problem posed by the contemporary religious situation in America. Do you understand what he's saying there? He is saying, after studying religion in America right now, in the 50s, it has a form of godliness, but it denies the power thereof. That's the quote that I gave you at the very beginning of today from Paul. They believe in God. That's what they'll tell you. But they less and less go to church. They believe in an afterlife, but less and less believe in that having anything to do with your actions here on earth. Less and less believe in hell, more and more believe that everybody goes to heaven, including dogs, of course. Let's see, bottom of page 4. It seems to me that a realistic appraisal of the values, ideals, and behaviors of the American people leads to the conclusion that Americans, by and large, do have their common religion, and that religion is the system familiarly known as the American way of life. You've heard that phrase before, haven't you? It is the American way of life that supplies American society with an overarching sense of unity amid conflict. It is the American way of life about which Americans are admittedly and unashamedly intolerant. It is the American way of life that provides the framework in terms of which the crucial values of American existence are couched. By every realistic criterion, the American way of life is the operative faith of the American people. So what's happened, according to this sociologist, and I think he's correct, is that Christianity in America has basically morphed into an American faith that is less tied to God and more tied to America. And it's all about pushing America forward, pushing the people forward. It's a humanistic Christianity that is not tied to the Bible. It is tied to feelings about God. The American Supreme Court has pretty much come to this conclusion as well. The reason they have no problem with certain phrases of religious origin being kept in government things, such as like the oath of office, where people will say, you know, so help me God, or in the court, so help me God this and so help me God that, is because it's just a custom. It's just part of the culture. It really has no religious content. It's been divorced from its original content. Think about how our entire country reacts during a time of crisis. They all say, we need to pray, right? Or we need to sing God Bless America, things like that. But you know this from personal experience. Many of the people who want to do those things have no real connection to biblical Christianity. It's a knee-jerk reaction. It is a secularized, religious, couched expression. And it's very frustrating. Last little bit. And we're almost out of time here, so this has to do with Eisenhower, who was the president at the time that this guy's writing. Americans believe in religion in a way that perhaps no other people do. It may indeed be said that the primary religious affirmation of the American people, in harmony with the American way of life, is that religion is a good thing, a supremely good thing for the individual and the community. And religion here means not so much any particular religion, but religion as such, religion in general. Here's a quote from Eisenhower. Our government makes no sense, President Eisenhower recently declared, unless it is founded in a deeply felt religious faith. And I don't care what it is. So it's just basically faith generic. God generic. The force, if you will, right? In saying this, the president was saying something that almost any American could understand and approve, but which must seem like a deplorable heresy to the European churchmen. Every American can understand first that Mr. Eisenhower's apparent indifferentism, and I don't care what it is, was not indifferentism at all, but the expression of the conviction that at bottom, the three great faiths were really saying the same thing in affirming spiritual ideals and moral values of the American way of life. Every American, moreover, can understand that what Mr. Eisenhower was emphasizing so vehemently was that the indispensability of religion as the foundation of society. This is one aspect of what Americans mean when they say that they believe in religion. The object of devotion of this kind of religion, however, is not God, but religion. The faith is not in God, but in faith. We worship not God, but our own worshiping. When Americans think of themselves as a profoundly religious people whose first allegiance is reserved to the kingdom of the Spirit, this is by and large what they mean, and not any commitment to the doctrines or traditions of the historic faiths. If you understand what this guy is talking about in the 50s, you will understand where we're at in 2018, where Christianity is expected to morph itself to accept whatever the common belief system of the American people are. So if homosexuality is now accepted nationwide, then that is part of the Christian American faith, and everybody needs to get on board with it. Any type of weird thing that goes against the doctrine of the Bible becomes the norm in America, it is pushed that the American church just needs to accept it and get on board with it. After all, that's part of the American faith. And you can see the problems with this. It was about their religion, their customs and their traditions. That's exactly correct. And you see this happen with the Jewish faith in the time of Jesus. It had already happened. And now it's happening very clearly here. And so what's the best solution for it? As Bible-believing Christians, we have to stand firm with the Scripture, regardless of what anybody else says. And when it comes into conflict with this American way of life and this secularized religiosity, we have to stand up and say, that's not Christianity. Those people need to repent. And we've got to do whatever we can to teach our young people not to suck up to that stuff.
I think what you just said, because if you're not being like the American Christian, that they would call us fundamentalists.
Yes, and not only fundamentalists, but dangerous. And that is why in some states already there are laws put forth to basically say you have to leave your fundamentalist teaching inside your building. You cannot take it outside your building in print or verbal form.
So what we call fundamentalism earlier, being extremist.
Yeah.
Then call me an extremist.
That's right. Yeah, and I'm fine with that. I'm good with that. But we should understand that the way things are moving, and they were already moving that way in the 50s, is that Bible-believing Christianity will be more and more marginalized and stigmatized, and you should not expect to be liked by the common American, quote, Christian, once they find out that you believe the Bible is the true Word of God and that everybody needs to be living by it. Right, and that's exactly right. If Jesus was not liked, don't expect to be liked. That's right. They'll ask you to pray for them, even though they don't believe in God, because you see, they're feeding into this idea of the American way of life Christian. It's a secularized religiosity. That's all it is. It has no real anchor in Bible-believing Christianity. And so we are in the minority as we sit here and talk about this. And you just need to accept that and realize it is part probably of that last day scenario that Paul was talking about at the very beginning of Lesson Day. Okay, I went way too far. Sorry. We'll be back to the 50s next week. Okay, we're going to talk about how that decade kind of set the tone for our next section of Christianity.